exhaust fumes could have caused the deaths of thousands of people from pneumonia, according to a study from Birmingham University.
The vehicle and engine manufacturers and the Petroleum Institute objected to cleaning up their emissions from diesel, despite knowing that 100,000 Americans die every single year prematurely from completely preventable petroleum-related air pollution. And I'm sorry, I don't know the statistics for Canada, but I'll bet proportionally, depending on your population, it's the same. They objected despite the fact they knew that 6.5 million Americans go to the hospital every single year with asthma and other respiratory diseases that can now be attributed directly to petroleum-related air pollution. They objected despite knowing the studies that now show that a child who lives within a mile of a busy urban freeway loses as much as 1% of his or her lung function every single year. And this is in the richest country in the history of this planet. We can't even protect our children from the ravages of diesel emissions.
That's Terry Tamminen from the introduction to his book, Lives Per Gallon. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. In this nonstop smog special, we have two new interviews for you. While scientists write papers on how smog kills, the most cited work in the world comes from Dr. Joel Schwartz from Harvard University. Dr. Schwartz testified to Congress. Today, we'll ask him how air pollution works and what we can do about it. That's a rare opportunity for EcoShock listeners. We're going to begin, though, by asking Dr. Ricky Ott of Alaska to explain her research into one of the most toxic byproducts of the internal combustion engine, a group of chemicals called PAHs. You need to know what these are because you are breathing them right now, and that's not good. We'll also cover two new air pollution studies. One was announced at the February meeting of the American Academy, and the other comes from England, where thousands of cases of pneumonia are directly related to traffic pollution. It's worse than the famous 1952 killer smog in Britain, and it happens every year unreported. No doubt you have noticed that every newspaper has full-page ads and often whole sections devoted to selling you cars and trucks with big engines. Every major TV newscast has millions of dollars in vehicle ads. This mainstream media is never going to warn you. The machines they sell are just as deadly as cigarettes. They deform babies right in the womb. They steal lung power from little kids, and they kill off Americans more than a dozen years before their time. We all drive. But do we need to die doing it? This program says no, and will give you the information you need to demand clean air. So take a deep breath. Radio EcoShock starts with Ricky Ott right after this short clip from Gino Vannelli.
We are here, DuPont. You are.
The sun goes down on the Arizona plain and the wind whistles by like a runaway train. It's a beautiful thing. Oh, it's me and you in a flatbed truck and my heart kicking up like a whitetail buck. In the middle of spring, you can cut me deep, you can cut me down, you can cut me low. So don't you know it's okay? Hey. You can kick and scream, you can slap my face, set my wheels on a high speed chase on you. No matter what you do.
Our guest today is Ricky Ott. She has a master's and doctorate in marine toxicology with a specialty in oil pollution from the University of South Carolina and the University of Washington. Ricky Ott has also been a commercial fisher person in Alaska out of the little town of Cordova on Prince William Sound. That was the perfect mix, I suppose you could say, to get to the bottom of a lot of propaganda and blame dodging after the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened right in her front yard. The result was Ricky Ott's influential book, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. In this book, we find out that oil is an extreme human and environmental poison, perhaps as important as DDT. So, Ricky, even though the car and the oil-powered model has totally taken us over, it seems like it took the Exxon Valdez spill to fund the real research asking, well, questions like, how toxic is this stuff anyway? What happened so that the spill drove this research?
Well, it's funny that actually was not the question immediately after the oil spill. The scientists told us that to keep our fishing permits, to keep fishing, yes, things were going to be bad for 1 year, but then it would recover rapidly. That's what they had seen in the other oil spills. That's what the scientists assumed from the 1970s research that had been done for the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. But what they didn't count on was the persistence of fishermen and the love that we all have for Prince William Sound. And when we didn't see this rapid recovery, we started asking questions. And what happened, there's sort of two things that happened. One, Exxon had the misfortune of spilling in Alaska, in Prince William Sound, a place that was very dear to a lot of people. The second thing was that the federal and state governments got after Exxon for a settlement for natural resource damages. That was $900 million plus a $100 million reopener clause. And that money was actually used to study this spill over the long term. Most oil spills get studied for 1 year after the spill, maybe 5 years later, that's it. So you're not really looking for long-term effects. So between the fishermen and the pot of money for the scientists, suddenly when we had fish runs collapse in 1992, pink salmon, and again in 93, along with the herring, the fishermen put it together really fast. And the fishermen said, look, what we're seeing is the animals, the fish that were babies, that were either eggs or embryo fish in 1989 and that were exposed to the really toxic oil, something must have happened to them because the pink salmon grew up, they came back, but they don't have any offspring. We had to wait 3 and 4 years for that. The herring that grew up in 89, the ones that survived, they were very sickly. They were stricken by disease is what it boiled down to. So their populations crashed as well, and then for subsequent years afterward, it turns out that the fishermen said, forget it. We're not believing the scientists anymore. The scientists, we think, are wrong. So we blockaded Valdez Narrows, which was an act of civil disobedience, and the whole purpose of that was to get public attention focused on this problem and get the scientists refocused. And that's what happened. As a result of the blockade, scientists undertook four ecosystem studies. And these studies had never really been done like this before. What the scientists looked for was multiple generations, oil effects on multiple generations of animals, oil effects on ecosystem effects. In other words, the food web interactions. They focused on young animals. They focused on a different fraction of oil called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons than the fraction of oil that had been the focus of the 1970 studies. And as a result of this, what the scientists determined was that oil, in fact, was much more toxic to animals than we thought in the 1970s. Now, we have to remember now that time is sort of passing, so we have about a decade of time here before the wildlife biologists kind of surfaced with their study results that said, hey, it's these things called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and they affect organisms differently. What happens is they get inside the cells, and they disrupt cell function so that the cells can't make proteins, hormones, enzymes, and it messes up reproduction. It messes up, immune suppression. It messes up the ability of these animals to transport oxygen in their blood. And the thing is, at this point in time, the medical doctors were also realizing that PAHs affect humans. And so the wildlife biologists actually used some of the techniques, the medical techniques, that had been developed for doing biomarker, forensic chemistry on humans to look for these PAHs in the blood of humans and figure out how they were interfering with human bodies. And the wildlife researchers took these and adopted them to study animals. So you have these kind of parallel studies going on with people and with animals. And now it's 1999. And at this point in time, I've had a lot of phone calls from sick people from the Exxon Valdez oil spill cleanup that made me question whether oil was actually also affecting humans. I didn't know really about the medical research at this point. I definitely knew something was up with the animals, and I started calling medical doctors. I called one in particular who had treated a lot of sick cleanup workers. His name is Dr. Ray, William Ray. He's down in Dallas, Texas. He runs a chemical detox center, specifically for low levels of poisons that we people pick up in our everyday lives from breathing urban air, from breathing, from just living. And it slowly accumulates to levels that can influence your health. So Dr. Ray had this detox center, and when he heard what was going on in Prince William Sound, he said, okay, look, if you have sick animals and you have sick wildlife, I'm sorry, if you have sick animals and you have sick people, and they're sick for the same reason, then that's the strongest evidence that you have that that chemical is a problem. And I said, but it's oil. And he said, so? And that's when I kind of went, whoa, what did I stumble onto here? So I started looking around. It actually wasn't until I started to write my book, Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, because I understood the animal story. That's what my doctorate and master's is in, oil pollution, marine pollution. But then I started trying to draw these parallels to humans, and I went and I looked around, and I found that in 1999, the United States Environmental Protection Agency actually listed 22 polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons on this list of persistent bioaccumulative toxic pollutants. And this list at the time was short: lead, dioxin, mercury, PCBs, and DDT. These chemicals or substances all have in common that they are very persistent and long-lasting, and they can build up in air, water, soil, bodies to levels that actually harm health of people and animals. And I was just shocked, because it was, I think, 2003 that I kind of came across this. And, I mean, here is oil, this compound, you know, that we use in our homes to heat. We use to make electricity. We burn in our cars and on our farms and in our school buses, for God's sakes. And it's listed as this hugely, highly toxic chemical by the EPA, and I hadn't heard anything about it. Well, then I find out that, so I started wondering, well, how much of these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are actually in our air and water, you know, that we would encounter mm-hmm. an average person just, you know, in our daily life. And I discover that the National Research Council has put out a new report called Oil and the Sea 3 in 2002 that talks about chronic inputs, fates, and effects of oil. And the National Research Council reported that over 90% of the PAHs in our coastal seas actually comes from burning fossil fuels. And this is in our power plants and in our thousands of little miniature smokestacks, our automobile emissions. And what happens is the unburnt hydrocarbons, and this includes PAHs, goes up into the air as fine particulates, comes down as with rain or snow or dust, settles, and then with more rain or snow, you get runoff, and basically it's all winding up in a heap in our coastal seas and in our traffic, you know, in our streets.
Well, this is the thing. You know, I've been reading studies in Europe that show that vehicle emissions are now the biggest single source of PAHs there. They say it's much more concentrated in the cities than in rural areas. And the worst spots are so-called street canyons. You know, and in my city, a lot of people are moving downtown. They're moving into great big high towers with a lot of traffic down below them. Aren't they going to be at risk?
Well, this is finally where we're at. In 2006, in September, the EPA here passed the soot rule, which is an attempt to regulate these very fine particulates from our emissions. There was a book written called Lives Per Gallon, and actually, which deals with the public health costs of our automobiles, of our lifestyle. And finally, in February, just this past February, out comes U.S. News and World Report showing basically now if you live within 300 feet of a freeway, so in your street canyons, if you live within 30 miles downwind of a refinery, if you drive 1 hour in rush hour traffic, you are literally shaving years off your life. And right now, the medical doctors have documented that more Americans die annually from these fine particles in our exhaust than from car accidents. What we're talking about here is about 60,000 premature deaths per year from emphysema, from asthma. Heart attacks now are linked with these ultra-fine particles, which are PAHs. And also childhood asthma. I mean, the number one childhood illness in the United States now is asthma. And what we're finding is clusters of children who play outdoors after school, like soccer or some organized sport, and their little lungs are just breathing like crazy this urban rush hour traffic. So I'm just waiting for the mothers, you know, to get mad like they did with the you know, mad mothers against alcohol or whatever that was, against drunk drivers, that's what it was called.
Well, there is one mother's group in Colorado who's demanding clean air for those reasons, and I know Columbia University did a study that showed PAHs combined with other air pollutants like pesticides actually changed the DNA of babies right in the womb with totally unknown consequences for those kids later in life, but we don't think it's going to be good.
That's exactly what we're finding. We are finding newborn babies now with like 287 chemicals in their bodies. I mean, there is no way that these kids, it was any choice of theirs. So what we're finding out is that, you know, these chemicals that we have pumped into our environment since World War II. I mean, basically there was a lot of chemicals developed for World War II. And then, well, how do we use those chemicals when the war ends? And let's try to put them in products and sell them. And we have tens of thousands of chemicals entering our U.S. market every year that we do not use the precautionary principle here like Europe does. The EU adopted the precautionary principle. They put health first. We put our economy first. And I think we are going to start to see here that Europe has a very good economy, and they manage it with putting health first. The reason Europe switched to the precautionary principle is because Europe has a lot of nations that pay for health costs, like Canada does, in fact. And in the U.S., you know, everything's privatized, and it's like the government is not seeing the long-term health consequences and costs of living with kids that have 300 chemicals in their bodies when they're born. So Europe is starting. The European Union now, which is some 550 million consumers, if you want to look at it that way, versus the U.S., which is 350 million, the European Union is starting to actually direct corporations to kinder, gentler, more earth-friendly products because Europe doesn't want to have to deal with the healthcare consequences.
Well, I know, too, in Europe, they're starting to demand more diesel particulate filters. The City of London just put those filters on all 7,000 of their City of London buses. there's a little bit of a move to do that in New York City, I know from talking to folks there, but in general, this just isn't on the roadmap or the menu of most American people, and it's certainly the trucking industry isn't doing anything about it. It's just unimaginable that we have some filters that could protect us a little bit and stop poisoning our kids, but that's not part of the regulations.
This is well within our technology to try to limit some of this, and beyond that, the real way to limit this is to get off oil. And I am just today, ironically, I am just working on drafting a letter to bring to Congress's attention that when they consider our energy future in America and the choice of energies that we have, I'm asking Congress to start considering the toxic effects of oil, because that's a huge strike against oil. And I think if people really understood that this stuff is on the list with PCBs and DDT and mercury, I mean, we don't put any of those chemicals in the gas tanks of our automobiles. What are we doing with oil? And we just need to buck up here and back down the oil lobby, which, of course, their solution to the energy shortage here is to just drill more. And I think that what we're going to see here is a pretty much a clash of values as people wake up that it's not all about making money. It's about having a quality of life and a health. Health counts as that. And we don't want to have to pay for that health. We want to have enough clean environment where we can be safe in our homes and eating our food and breathing our air and not have this poison lurking. We have switched energy choices in the past, and granted, we weren't as complex a society back then. But once we went from wood to coal, and then we went from coal to oil, and I really think it's past time to really make the plunge here for a bunch of reasons to get off oil.
We definitely have to get off oil. We're talking with Dr. Ricky Ott, the author of Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. Well, what's coming up for you? What are you working on now, Dr. Ott?
Three things, actually. I'm working on another book called Not One Drop, which should be out this next fall. That one is on the community-level trauma from the Exxon Valdez disaster and the ramifications of that. Dealing with that disaster, learning what we could to mitigate it, how we could reduce the risk of disaster trauma for future disasters, what that means for society. Because what the sociologists are saying now is that in these big man-made disasters, a lot of them end up with class action litigation, which actually ends up further traumatizing people and doesn't really bring justice. And what the sociologists are saying is we better figure it out, because global climate change has a huge human imprint, and we're all going to be tied in a litigious knot here unless we make some adjustments in our legal system. So that's one thing. Another one is that actually there is a Quebec film crew working on a legacy film on the Exxon Valdez oil spill and global implications for society. That includes what we just talked about, sick animals, sick people, and sick communities, and what we've learned from all that for our future. So that's the second thing. And then the third one is still working with Congress to try to drive home the lessons from this oil spill. And actually, I'm working with a lot of high school kids, young kids, to try to help the young kids deal with the largest disaster of their generation, global climate change, and help us older kids realize that this really is happening, and we have to do everything we can to make sure these kids succeed with some of their ideas in shifting us off oil.
Those are some really worthwhile projects. Can you give us your website where people can learn more about your work?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much for having me. It is soundtruth.info. That's Prince William Sound telling her truth.
Soundtruth.info for Dr. Ricky Ott. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Coming up, Dr. Joel Schwartz and how smog kills.
cause it's getting harder and harder to breathe.
No, does it kill, does it burn, is it painful to learn that it's me that is all the control?
This summer, people like you will head out into the traffic, getting to work or picking up kids, even though the air is brown. It feels gritty, smells burnt. An alarming number of these ordinary people will be found dead, slumped over the wheel, or crumpled up on the sidewalk. The victims are pronounced dead at the hospital. Most death certificates will say heart attack. The real cause was air pollution, but the system doesn't count that. We are learning the death toll and other health impacts of air pollution from the work of a relatively few number of scientific studies. The subject hasn't been a big priority for governments, who know the economy is built by GM, Ford, Volkswagen, and Toyota. One of the major health studies has been ongoing since the 1970s at Harvard University at the Harvard School of Public Health. And Dr. Joel Schwartz, an environmental epidemiologist, has become one of the prominent advocates for cleaner air in America and elsewhere. 3 years ago, Dr. Schwartz told congressional staffers that based on his extensive studies, smog is killing 250,000 Americans a year. Quote, that's more than AIDS, plus breast cancer, plus prostate cancer, plus colon cancer, put together. End quote. Frankly, judging by their reaction to such warnings, the American government just doesn't give a damn. And just this March, the Bush administration was forced to reduce the amount of low-level ozone in our air. The American Lung Association has been clamoring for an ozone cleanup for years, saying lung damage from this smog component is hurting millions of people. But they had to join a lawsuit in 2003, filed by the legal outfit Earth Justice, with the environment groups Environmental Defense, Natural Resources Defense Council, and Sierra Club, among others, to push the government to enact its own Clean Air Act laws. 5 years of court battles later, the EPA announces an anemic improvement, an 8-hour limit of 0.075 parts per million instead of 0.08. Well, that's a change of 0.005, despite decades of new scientific understanding of smog since the Clean Air Act was passed back in the 1970s. That's all you get. Yet according to an ongoing Harvard study, ozone pollution is nasty, but tiny carbon particles, soot, is the big killer. The human body has no defense for these microscopic particles, so let's take a minute to learn about them.
It ain't pretty, and it could be dangerous.
There has always been dust. That is why you have hair in your nose, to help filter it out. The lungs have their own protective mechanisms. But industrial society has added two new features. First of all, tiny particles attract all kinds of these new toxic chemicals which were never present in natural air. These are the pesticides, a whole range of other human-made industrial chemicals, and heavy metals. Some of the heavy metal particles are actually from the breakdown in car and truck engines. Pistons and engine walls wear away and fly off into the air around us. A whole range of other toxic chemicals, including mercury and radioactive particles, comes from the smoke of coal-fired power stations. But the second factor, industrially produced particles are smaller than anything found in nature. They are measured in microns. I'll explain that in a minute. These tiny particles go into your lungs, but they don't stop there. They go directly through the cell wall system into your bloodstream. The toxic chemicals, heavy metals, and soot collect in your arteries and organs. Eventually, a major artery is blocked near the heart, and death results. To get the best of smog science explained for the general public, you should download two short podcasts I did 2 years ago. On the EcoShock Features page, grab a 21-minute piece called The Polluted Womb. It is an expose on science that shows how vehicle emissions damage the genes of babies right in the womb. That piece of work on Dr. Frederica Pereira of the Columbia Mailman School of Health was chosen for an independent producer showcase on the Pacifica network of stations in California. You should also get my earlier EcoShock feature on the work of Dr. Schwartz called Let's Talk About Smog. I'm just going to play a quick clip which explains the tiny exhaust particles that kill. In Europe, particles are measured by the number of micrograms per cubic meter. The authorities have decided that the 24-hour average should not exceed 65 micrograms per cubic meter. By comparison, when people smoked at the back of airplanes in the old days, they inhaled 200 or 300 micrograms per cubic meter. In North America, we only count particles 2.5 microns in diameter or less, the size that penetrates deeply into our breathing system. These are so-called fine particles. You'll hear scientists discuss the air quality as particulate matter 2.5 or PM2.5. Almost half the PM2.5 particles come from burning carbon, and 30 to 40% come from sulfates, depending on where you live. A period at the end of a sentence would contain at least 600 microns, maybe more. Human eyes can't see them. But is there any safe level? Is there a threshold where the human body tolerates particles in their lungs, beyond which we die? The Harvard team selected 6 cities in the United States, ranging from the former steel town of Steubenville, Ohio, to the less polluted Madison, Wisconsin. When all air quality and death rates were calculated, the scientists did not find any safe threshold. There is no really safe level of exhaust particles for humans, and not just humans. When Boston street air was given to lab rats, they died too. After 15 years of the study, statistics clearly showed the worse the air pollution, the sooner people died. Dr. Schwartz tells us, quote, "The difference in life expectancy between the cleanest town and the dirtiest town, it's 2 years," end quote. Some humans are more susceptible than others. Those with medical conditions like diabetes are threatened by smog. People already sick with respiratory infection have a lower threshold. And it turns out 50% of the population has a gene that helps them detoxify a bit, which others lack. It's a 50-50 genetic chance. In one study in Philadelphia, there was a 7% increase in total deaths on smoggy days compared with clean air days. But these are not just feeble people who would have died within a few days anyway. The California Air Resources Board concludes smog-related premature deaths take away 14 years of expected living on average. Most victims would never have guessed that smog would suddenly kill them. Yet, our method of collecting death statistics lists the cause of death as heart attack or arrhythmia, not air pollution. As I say, you can download that whole feature, Let's Talk About Smog, at our website, ecoshock.org, on the EcoShock Features page. Well, we know how this works. The science is in, but the public doesn't know much, and governments who have been too well informed by experts like Dr. Joel Schwartz are ignoring the deaths of hundreds of thousands of their citizens. If a serial killer left 10 bodies along the New York State Thruway, a team of hundreds of cops would investigate. If 1,000 bodies were found, the FBI and the terrorism teams would sweep in to stop the killing. But when our unregulated transportation system kills hundreds of thousands of our people, it doesn't even make the front page of the paper. You don't hear it raised in the presidential debates. We drive dirty and power up dirty and die dirty without any protest.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat.
Okay, let's hear from Dr. Schwartz himself in this exclusive Radio EcoShock interview.
So you put that all together and it's clear that particles in the air are triggering heart attacks and arrhythmias and killing tens of thousands of people a year.
Well, I have to say, as a layperson, I am confused sometimes about the different dangers in air pollution. One scientist warns about ozone. You're talking about microparticles, and then we have the PAHs. Can you help us quickly to understand the differences between these things and how important each might be?
Sure. There are many different kinds of air pollutants that we produce in our society, and many of them are bad for us. Usually in different ways. The pernicious thing about particles, which you produce from any kind of combustion, is that they seem to have effects not just in the lungs, which you might expect, you breathe them in, but that get out into the rest of the body. And partly that's because the very smallest particles, which you get particularly from traffic and diesel engines, are stellar productions of nanoparticles, can actually get out of the lung and into the bloodstream directly. And the other ones that get stuck in the lungs nevertheless have metals and other things on them that are soluble and can get out into the body and do things. So they tend to have more of the effects on cardiovascular disease. Ozone is a very oxidizing gas. I mean, it's like bleach, in a sense. And when you inhale it, it causes a lot of irritation in the lung. And over the long term, that may do a lot of bad things. And there are studies in monkeys showing permanent lung damage as a result of that. And in the short run, if you have pneumonia or some other respiratory disease, it can make it get worse. And of course, if you make everybody's respiratory diseases get worse, more people are going to die from them. And so there's some mortality that's associated with ozone exposure as well. PAHs, some of them are particles, in fact, and some of them are gases. And the primary concern with them is that they're carcinogenic. And so EPA estimates are that as a result of those things, there are hundreds of cases of cancer a year as a result of PAHs in the air. However, that's much smaller than the amount of excess deaths due to particles in general from heart and lung disease, which is on the order of 100,000 or 200,000 deaths per year. So in rank ordering, I would say particles are the biggest problem, followed by ozone, and PAHs are a problem, but they're a much smaller one.
Well, some of the studies that I've seen, one by Frederica Pereira, for example, seem to point towards a mixture of pesticides with the vehicle emissions. Do we know the real toxicity of just the vehicle emissions, independent of these other toxic chemicals sort of swimming around in our air?
No, that's a very good point. We aren't exposed to pure particles of any particular kind, and that slowed down toxicological studies for a long time because they didn't know what to expose their animals to. And when they took pure particles of a particular type, pure ammonium sulfate or pure carbon soot, you know, nothing much happened. I mean, you know, at high doses, things happened, but it didn't seem to fit in with the epidemiology. And then they started sucking in particles from out of the air in cities, concentrating them up a bit, and sending these higher concentration doses of particles into chambers with animals, and all sorts of stuff started happening. So clearly these things are interacting with each other, and that's part of the problem of figuring out which are the things of greatest concern. There are, you know, some studies that do point to traffic particles being worse than average in ways that it seemed reasonably convincing. There was a study done in Germany where they found that they interviewed people in the intensive care unit after they'd had a heart attack. They interviewed everybody in the city of Stuttgart who came in, you know, with a heart attack during a certain period and survived long enough to be interviewed. And they asked them, well, you know, what were you doing in the couple of hours before the heart attack happened? And, you know, what about the same day of the week, same time of the day last week? What were you doing? And they compared the answers. And the big difference was that they were a lot more likely to have been in traffic on the day that they had their heart attack. And it seemed like being in traffic caused an immediate increase in your risk of having a heart attack for that hour that you were in traffic. And so it's hard to imagine that that doesn't give a strong signal towards traffic particles. But nevertheless, those traffic particles do, and fresh traffic particles, before they've had a chance to pick a lot of other stuff up. And there are some other studies looking at diesel engine exhaust that have found changes in people. But certainly particles do pick things up on their surface and do become very complex mixtures. And so the bigger particles, it's even more of a problem. So that larger particles are more likely to have pesticides and herbicides and things on them. And that's why, you know, people in farming communities argue, well, you know, most of the particles in our air are wind-blown dust. That can't really be bad for you. And if it was just, you know, clay, that would be true. But it's not. It's clay that has pesticides and herbicides and all sorts of other stuff attached to its surface. And so it may well be that the clay is just acting as a vehicle, as it were, for getting other stuff into your lung.
And how small are the particles that you've been studying that are dangerous? And, well, just how small are they?
Well, the big division is between combustion particles, particles that are produced by burning stuff, right, and particles that sort of occur in the natural world by erosion and things being ground down and stuff. And combustion particles are less than a micron in diameter. So that's a millionth of a meter. So they're really small. They're much thinner than a hair. And those particles are more likely to have dangerous chemicals on them and lots of metals on them and things like that. But as you said, partly that's by mixing with each other and picking up these things and changing. But those are the most dangerous particles. Now, the other particles you get in the air are basically between, well, you get particles of all sizes, right? But the bigger they are, the quicker they fall out. And so the ones that are between 1 and 10 microns are still small enough to get down your throat and into your lung. And those tend to be produced by mining, by plowing, by cars driving over the road and kicking up dust, by all sorts of, or by wind-blown dust if you're in a dry area. And those particles have cores that if you sort of looked at them under a super microscope, they're little rocks, right? I mean, that's what they are. But the problem is they're little rocks that have all sorts of stuff attached to the outside. And what that stuff is varies a lot from place to place. And so they don't seem, on average, to be as toxic, but there's a wide variability.
I'm told that one reason that diesel fuel for North American truckers has become so expensive is a majority of the cars sold in Europe have diesel engines now because they get a little better mileage. Do these new European cars have sufficient particle filters to protect the population?
No. If I put a blindfold on you and flew you around in an airplane for 24 hours, landed you, took you out of the airport, put you on a city street with the blindfold, you could tell me whether you were in America or Europe just by smelling the air. They have much more diesel particles in the air in Europe than we do. And in general, particulate air pollution is higher in Europe than in North America because of this fascination with diesel. They have new standards that are starting to kick in called the Euro 5 standards, which will require fairly strict control on diesel engines, but still not quite as strict as the new standards that EPA put out in 2007 for diesel cars and trucks in the United States. So they're still going to be dirtier than the same cars sold in the U.S. But the problem with diesel engines is that they last a very long time. And these new rules only apply to new cars and trucks. And so all the old cars and trucks, now in the U.S., there are very few cars, so all the old trucks don't have to retrofit. In Europe, not only do they have old trucks that don't have to retrofit, but they have a huge number of cars that were bought when control standards were much more lax, and they're going to be on the road for 10 years.
So they're looking at a new health problem that in the making.
Absolutely, and that's why, you know, a funny thing happened in Europe a couple of years ago, which is they had these scientific panels that recommended what their particle standards should be, and then all of a sudden, you know, the auto industry went in and basically torpedoed that, and they completely turned around from what their initial proposal was to come out with a much weaker particle standard, so that in the United States, our standard is that for these combustion particles, no more than 15 micrograms per cubic meter as an annual average. In Europe, it's 25 micrograms per cubic meter as an annual average. It's 60% higher levels that they tolerate, and they still have a very large number of cities that are that aren't going to make it.
Well, Harvard's been studying air pollution since the 1970s, and I know that you have testified about it before Congress. What should we be doing about this problem?
Well, you know, I like to tell people that particulate air pollution kills more people a year in the United States than AIDS, breast cancer, and prostate cancer put together. But the difference is we know the cure. We just need to do it. And so there are still a large number of power plants in the United States that don't have scrubbers on them to remove the precursors, the chemicals that turn into particles once they get out of the smokestack. And EPA issued a rule a couple of years ago to bring down particle levels in the U.S. that required them to reduce their emissions of sulfur oxides, which is the main thing they put out that turns into particles. But when that rule is fully in effect, which isn't going to be for, you know, another 10 years, 25% of the power plants in the United States will still not have scrubbers on them. So there's a real simple thing you could do. You could say, no, I'm sorry. You want to have a coal-burning power plant? You need a scrubber. And that would take care of the remaining 25%. They issued a fairly stringent rule for diesel engines, but no retrofit requirement. You know, and on construction equipment and trucks and things, these engines last for 30 years. So a simple thing to do is to say, you know, these engines get rebuilt every 3 to 5 years. When you take it in to rebuild it, you put on a particle filter, period. And in 5 years, every diesel engine in America would have a particle filter or be replaced by a new one that has a particle filter. So there are things that you can do. We just need the political will to do it.
Well, Dr. Joel Schwartz, it's been a privilege talking with you. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, one thing that I think is becoming more became an issue in the 70s and at the high price of oil is coming back is wood-burning stoves. And if, you know, if you live in a cabin in Montana, that's a great way to heat your house. But if you live in a county with 1 million people, you're using a technology that has, you know, relatively poor combustion that produces a large amount of particles that come out of a very low chimney into the street that all your neighbors live on. And I'm nervous that we had a very bad problem with that in the 70s, and there's a chance that it's going to start coming back, and we need to be very careful about that.
Well, thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Joel Schwartz of Harvard University, and I really appreciate your coming on the show today.
Sure thing.
That was Dr. Joel Schwartz. He is a professor of environmental epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. You should know that the black carbon soot we have been talking about as a public health risk is also the second largest cause of global warming. Unlike sulfate particles, which reflect sunlight and may even temporarily cool the Earth, black soot absorbs sunlight and increases global warming. This is particularly true as these vast collections of airborne soot land on the snowy Arctic. The snow becomes a dirty gray color, which absorbs vast amounts of heat, instead of the white reflecting it back into space. Dr. Schwartz testified at a hearing on black carbon and global warming at the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. It was chaired by Henry Waxman on October 18, 2007. Dr. Schwartz was one of five leading American researchers to testify. Joel Schwartz made a strong case that the United States should clean up its own carbon emissions at home rather than depending on global emissions trading. While it makes sense to help the Chinese reduce their emissions as they develop, America is one of the two top polluters in the world, and cleaning up American coal smokestacks with scrubbers and American vehicle emissions with particle filters or electric cars would have a double benefit. It would help fight off the worst of climate change and save hundreds of thousands of American lives a year. I've been saying this all along. We are just deluding ourselves to death, thinking we can go on polluting in North America or Europe by buying credits in some faraway land. Everyone has to stop pollution where they live. For those Europeans who feel superior to America when it comes to being green, Dr. Schwartz has a shocking message. Europeans are literally in danger of their lives due to continued dependence on dirty coal power, and now the added increase of particulates from all those new diesel car sales. In his presentation to Congress, which is available on the net as a PDF file, there is one of the two most frightening maps I have ever seen. The most scary map ever of the current age was posted by Sir James Lovelock in his late 2007 presentation to the Royal Society. It shows the developing New Earth regime under climate change. The tropics dry out and balloon up toward the Arctic, where the last remaining temperate wet zones remain. It is a remaking of the Earth coming every day. But Dr. Joel Schwartz has a close second with his simple map showing black carbon emission zones on the planet. Heavily polluted areas are shown in gray. Zones loaded with deadly particulates are shown in black. In North America, there are gray zones with black circles along the northeast, along the Louisiana-Texas refinery zone, and of course in Southern California. These are where most smog deaths occur. But all of Europe is one vast gray area, and there are massive concentrations of black dots. People there are being poisoned whether they know it or not by the smog of coal power and vehicle emissions. There is almost nowhere in Europe to escape from it. The public health bill and the loss, personal loss from unnecessary deaths, will be enormous. There is another new report on another way to die from smog, this time in England. Professor George Knox, emeritus professor at Birmingham University, has found a direct link between exhaust fumes and death by pneumonia. By cross-checking statistics, Knox found that during an 8-year period up to 2004, the 35 smoggiest areas of Britain had 14,000 more pneumonia deaths than the national average. While deaths of all kinds, including cancer, rose in smoggy areas, pneumonia was the killer that stood out in his study. Professor Knox said, quote, "Road transport was the chief source of the emissions." He compared these deaths as greater than the 4,000 killed in London in the early 1950s. It's a continuing plague caused by car and truck exhaust. His study was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. On the map presented to Congress by Dr. Joel Schwartz, another black and gray belt of death, mostly black, extends across the whole of northern India, where almost a billion people live. And as you would expect, much of China is saturated with dangerous gray and deadly black. We can expect hundreds of millions of deaths in China and India just from industrial smog. Electric-powered cars, trucks, and trains could save many of these people. The power would have to come from carbon-free, renewable energy. Or we could stop making new cars until we find health solutions. Why kill ourselves? We know how to do this, but apparently humanity has more decades of unimaginable suffering and personal loss before we try.
A scientist tells people the truth. When times are good, when the truth offers no threat, people don't mind. But when times are very, very bad, well, a magician tells people what they wish were true.
If you made it to the end of this broadcast, you have already taken the first step. Most people cannot stand to hear about it, much less demand action. Now you know, smog hurts your children and might kill you before your time, and it is preventable. And the same actions that cut carbon soot also help prevent the worst of climate change. The two battles are closely related. The answer is to stop burning carbon. In the meantime, I am exposed just like you. Being poor, my home is just 300 yards from a busy 4-lane highway. the danger zone. There is a 6-lane freeway within a mile. The government wants to make it 8 lanes, and 80 diesel trains a day pass by in the little valley below me. Inside my house, I have 2 HEPA air filters running 24 hours a day. I wanted to ask Dr. Schwartz whether these would save my lungs and heart, but I already know the answer. They help, but the only real solution is to move out of the gray zone, to leave the city for cleaner country air, and one day, some years soon, I will do just that. But first, I'll join you to fight for cleaner air.
Wake up!
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next week, we will plunge into the awful news I've been trying to ignore while we tackled those basic things like solar solutions and smog. All the while, underneath the urge to shop, something is crawling, eating up the shops and homes. The economy is crumbling much faster than the illusion that mass media presents. We'll talk about getting out of the matrix, living off-grid, whether you choose to leave, or whether you fall off the consumer Ferris wheel. Kicked out, foreclosed, while food and gas prices go ballistic, next week, like every week, The Awful Truth on Radio EcoShock. Find our past programs, plus new speeches and free downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Thanks for hanging in. I hope I have brightened your day. Here is another clip from the band Midnight Oil.
Living easy, loving free, a season to